From reviews to rankings, The Big Picture is all things movies. From in-depth analysis of the latest flick to sit-down interviews with some of the biggest movie stars and filmmakers on the planet, Sean Fennessy and Amanda Dobbins have got you covered. Check out The Big Picture on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power the collaboration needed for teams to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from sports exploration and green energy to delivering pizza and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 200, or 2 million, Atlassian software is built to help keep you connected and moving together as one.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me live from the Hex, it's Andy Greenwald.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
What time is that?
Thursdays.
Oh yeah, I love Thursdays with you, man. Greenwald, I'm in a really good mood today. I don't know about you, but I just feel like the sun came back out here in Los Angeles. A giant oak tree fell around the corner from my house, and I just saw the city come together and just carve that bad boy up and just like take care of it. And buses, you know, are running on time.
Agatha Harkness?
No, it was just actually like, you know, the Garcetti just pushed the button and the Lumberjacks came out. I didn't even know that the LA had a squad like that. So the vibes are good. Today on the show, we're going to talk a little bit about WandaVision going into the finale. So by the time you hear this, you may have already watched the finale for all I know, but I thought we would talk a little bit about that. And as an extension of a little bit of our collective breakdown that we had on Monday's pod, I thought we would address that. I also want to get into the only film that I will be watching for the rest of 2021, which is Amazon Original Films' Tom Clancy's Without Remorse, which is a movie that was made from, like, they took a piece of my DNA, like the Prometheus alien, and just made a movie out of it. We're also going to talk a little bit about Party Down coming back. Where do you want to go first?
And It's a Sin. We're talking It's a Sin.
Of course, yeah. And we're also talking about the best show of the year, It's a Sin. So we finished that. So I would say it's a 5-episode show. It's me and Andy's favorite show of the year so far. So save the second half for when you have finished the show, I would say. We're going to talk with spoilers. But Andy and I wanted to devote the second half of today's show to It's a Sin.
Yes. But first, everyone's favorite topic, WandaVision. I just wanted to come back and say you were very kind to say that we had a collective meltdown. I think I had a meltdown.
Yeah.
Personally on Monday. And specifically, I just wanted to say that, like, I don't love some of the things that I said on Monday in retrospect, and I kind of wanted to address it and also just kind of apologize. Basically, first of all, my opinions about the show, I stand by, and we'll continue to talk about in detail on next Monday after we've seen the finale. But as Chris was alluding to, you know, we kind of got swept up in talking about the discourse around the show, which is a little bit meta, a little bit tricky, a little bit difficult to manage and juggle, and probably not the best move, especially if you also have a case of the Mondays, as I definitely did. And what happened was I mentioned a tweet that I had seen by somebody.
I mentioned it.
But I had seen it, you know, by Madison Hatfield. And I didn't even name her because I did the thing that people do on Twitter that I don't like particularly, and I don't like in myself for doing, which is basically didn't really see who wrote it, didn't consider the context at all, just saw the words and fed it into my own personal emotional combustion engine and created a straw man, or in this case, a straw woman, that was kind of expressing feelings that I was already prepared to be kind of annoyed about. And that was totally unfair to Madison, and also probably by extension to the listeners of this podcast. Her opinions are valid. Her opinions are her own. She's a talented writer in her own right. And also, there was a lot more going on there. I don't think she's the mega fan that the Twitter megaphone turned her into.
Sure.
And so I reached out, I apologized to her privately, and she was gracious enough to say it was okay to share that with everybody here. But that's just not the kind of person or podcaster I want to be. And I feel like I kind of got heated. And it's, yeah. I mean, we could get into why. I think that clearly this show represents kind of a tipping point for us in our coverage, which is it almost less about the show itself, which, you know, I think remains a solid B minus, and maybe it'll raise itself up before Monday, but just our own deep, deep ambivalence about the coming franchise IP tsunami and how we fit into it and how we're going to cover it. And so that's a separate conversation. I think, as Chris alluded to, I see the sun shining through his window. I feel exercised a little bit.
Sure.
As opposed to feeling exercised, which I did on Monday.
Where to start with this? I think it's worth, if you don't mind, like pulling the curtain back a little bit and saying that I feel like there has been an accelerated cycle that reminds me a little bit of Thrones with this, where something becomes central and sort of essential to talking about pop culture like WandaVision has. And some people might be like, if you just don't like it, why would you talk about it? And I think that that's actually been a rule that we've abided by for the majority of the near decade that we've been doing this podcast. Like, people often will be like, you guys haven't talked about this, you guys haven't talked about that for certain shows. And for the most part, the reason why Andy and I don't do that is either we haven't had a chance to really dive into it, or we didn't particularly care for it, but we're not here to piss on anybody's party. You know, so like, if you like that show, well, you don't need two guys being like, here's why this show isn't as good as people think it is. And I feel annoyed that I let myself fall into that with WandaVision. Mostly because I actually think WandaVision's pretty good. Like, if you go back the 6 weeks that we've been talking about this, or the 7 weeks that we've been talking about this, we definitely started out on the right foot. I think I have always expressed my feeling that I was much more, I think I appreciated the craftsmanship of the show way more than I connected with the show. And that's just me being honest about like whether or not something is unlocking anything for me. The same way that I think when we talk about It's a Sin, I almost had a hard time understanding the craftsmanship of the show because it was so emotionally overwhelming. Do you know what I mean? Like, these things can go in different ways. You can experience culture in so many different ways. It's the same reason why, like, you can love a piece of punk rock that's barely two chords and not care for prog rock that's clearly the work of people who went to the Berklee School of Music. I mean, everything has a purpose in your life. I would just say with WandaVision, though, like with the Thrones thing, I remember towards the end of Thrones, it just felt like you were dragging a boulder up a hill, you know, because you felt like already everything was about what wasn't going to work out with it, you know? And I felt that way, unfortunately, with something like WandaVision, which I think is clearly experimental for Disney, not necessarily experimental in the grand scheme of avant-garde art, but just like a kind of a left turn for Disney and for Marvel. And I think all of a sudden I got very caught up in a lot of the same feelings I had towards the end of Thrones, where it was like, this isn't, they're not pulling off what they think they're pulling off, or what people have been led to believe this thing is actually, it's not going to be that. And that honestly doesn't really have too much to do with the story they're telling, the performances that are telling that story, and everything else. So I feel bad about that. You know, it was funny, like, I don't know the validity of this story, but like, you know, Paul Bettany gave some interview and he was basically like, I am the Luke Skywalker cameo. Like, the Luke Skywalker level cameo that people were referring to is me being White Vision at the end of the show. And now I feel like Paul Bettany is my number one draft pick for dudes who may not have checked their email and been like, oh yeah, by the way, Reed Richards is on this show. Like, he may have no idea if something else is coming. And he might also be Benedict Cumberbatching this, where Benedict Cumberbatch had to swear for like 2 years that he wasn't Khan in Star Trek. And then like was like, psych, well, I am.
Also, I wouldn't be surprised if Benedict Cumberbatch is in tonight's episode of WandaVision.
As Khan, yeah.
Potentially as Khan.
Yeah.
I hear what you're saying. I agree with you. I think that in retrospect, what I realized that's been happening in front of everyone's eyes as a slow motion car crash for the last 7-8 weeks for me is this kind of creeping realization that Disney's going to Disney. And it actually comes from a place of perhaps unwarranted optimism about television as a storytelling medium. And it happened with Mandalorian 2, which isn't to say that I expect these projects to be as emotionally engaging and bold as It's a Sin or as The Leftovers or other, or even Damon's Watchmen, you know, other shows that we like and admire. It's that I love the idea that they're going to be left alone to be their own thing, because that's really the dream of any creator in any medium, right? Is to like be able to carve out a little something that feels aesthetically right to his or her or their taste.
Yeah.
And we were much more enthusiastic about, well, I'll use I statements to be careful here. But I was much more enthusiastic about The Mandalorian when it felt like Jon Favreau's weird A-team slash samurai movie slash classic
spaghetti western. Yeah.
That was just on the margins, you know, and then Luke Skywalker shows up and I have a lot more complicated feelings about it because in fact, it is just the same thing we've been watching all along. And I think that those first two, three episodes of WandaVision were really exciting to me because I thought, and to a degree they have allowed it. I mean, it's true. It's different. It's a little stranger. There's no question about that. But part of me believed, maybe Charlie Brown with the football, that this was going to turn into something kind of weird and psychological. And it's weirder. It's more psychological.
Sure.
But it is the same thing. And I think I need to, you know, recalibrate myself accordingly, which is not a problem for me or the wildly successful show. I just sort of needed to punch that into my synthesoid mainframe. And the only other thing that I wanted to say while we're doing a little mea culpa-ing and responding to the responses is, you know, I admit it, I unintentionally made it personal and people got very upset. And I noticed people also made it personal about me, about my own failings and inability to write something like WandaVision, which I will say very clearly, I couldn't do this. I'm not claiming that my ability as a critic or even as a screenwriter is equal to this. This is hard. I'm saying that I'm capable of giving Chris pretty decent to good recipes for chicken marinades for his barbecue grill. I'm not telling him how to micro-engineer the Cool Ranch flavor to put on his homemade chips. You know what I mean?
Sure.
That's a skill. And to do it and still have the ambition and the heart to come up with interesting lines about grief, to have the in-jokes within the in-jokes. I mean, I remain in awe of the production.
Yeah.
This has been helpful, honestly, to help like realign where we are and also where we are in relation to the show, which is just a perfectly good fine show.
Yes.
It's not as big.
I don't think that you and I started this week to week journey thinking that we would end here where we were like, well, we certainly didn't think we would end like basically walking back like the vitriol that we had on Monday. But I think that we didn't anticipate getting to this point where we would be this frustrated with the show. Yeah. And I don't know that our frustration really has anything to do with what we're seeing on screen. I think it's two people kind of working out this honestly, like kind of fucked up, like push-pull relationship we have to the IP that we talk about all the time. And, you know, sure, we try to give as much time as we can to the stuff that we love, no matter what it is. So whether it's Mandalorian or it's I May Destroy You or it's things that like nobody cares about apparently, like The Head, you know, like we'll talk about it and enjoy it. And I think that with WandaVision, we were like, this requires like a weekly check-in. This requires a State of the Union every week. That being said, before we get into the final episode tonight, I did want to kind of steal a couple of questions from Daniel Chin's excellent Loose Ends piece. So Daniel Chin's been recapping the show every week for The Ringer, and he's been doing a fantastic job on that, much like Lindbergh did with Mandalorian. And then I also just wanted to recommend that people check out Charles Holmes's piece on basically everything that Andy and I just talked about, which is like our relationship to WandaVision and what people want from this show versus what the show is actually giving them. And it also has some deep dive on some of the comic stuff. But Daniel had a Loose Ends piece just saying like, here, going into this final episode, what are some questions? So I thought I would just like throw these at you and you tell me not like how much you care about them, but whether or not you think that they're important to answer. Does that sound good?
Okay, sure.
Okay. So what's up with fake Pietro? Like, do you think that that is something that they need to account for? That is the whether it's the Fox crossover part, the multiverse part, or whether this is just an Agatha trick. If it's just an Agatha trick, what do you think of that?
Well, I think it's all of it, and I think that speaks to, you know, the brilliance of this creative team at Marvel. It's not just about making the right choices in the moment; it's about the optionality, to steal a word from ESPN analysts. It can be all of those things. It was a knowing wink to people who were eagerly anticipating an answer to the question of how Kevin Feige is going to integrate the X-Men and the Fox property into the MCU. It was also, as was revealed in the last week, kind of, you know, a meta wink from the characters herself, from Agatha, basically being like, I had to recast. Mm-hmm. My guess is it ends there for the purposes of this show, but real heads know multiverses are coming. X-Men and the Fox integration, such as it is coming. And this allows, it's just a clever way for Feige and his team to keep the ball in the air without committing one way or another. So Evan Peters could play Quicksilver again in the MCU.
Evan Peters could referee the Deadpool-Logan fight that I want.
That you want so badly. Right. We don't know. And they probably have made some decisions, but we don't know and we don't need to know yet. But it keeps it in the air.
Next loose end is, who is the missing person that Jimmy Woo is looking for?
Oh my God, I don't even remember. Was that what brought him into S.W.O.R.D. Yes. In the beginning?
Yeah. That's what brings him across the country from San Francisco to Westview.
I hope it's Bobby Cannavale's character from the Ant-Man movies.
I hope it's Bobby Cannavale's character from Vinyl.
I hope it's Bobby Cannavale's character from Boardwalk Empire, missing in New Jersey.
I could help them out with that case. What's up with the twins? Is this magic? Are we going to get the new Avengers? What's up? Young Avengers?
This is the big question, I think, that is of interest to me for what they want to do with the character and the idea of chaos magic or whatever is going forward. In the comics, they had it both ways. They were made up, and now they're also Young Avengers.
Cool.
And I'm so sorry. I do not remember how they squared that particular circle. My guess is she made them up, or that they are going to put them away. While they set up whatever's coming next, is it possible that the next move for Wanda is to, as now a magic user in this universe, will she go seek out Dr. Stephen Strange? Can you help me? Because I know there are multiverses out there where my children are real, where yeah. Vision is alive, where Evan Peters is Pietro. Can you help me find them, perhaps in a multiverse of madness coming to theaters near you? I mean,
I hope
that could be a setup.
I hope when she finds them, they've aged to like their early to mid 30s and they're played by Garrett Hedlund and Tim Riggins, or Garrett Hedlund and Taylor Kitsch, the two Tim Rigginses.
I also would like that. Here's my real
answer. And it's just like, instead of the Spider-Man meme, it's two guys standing in shearling jean jackets pointing at each other.
I would watch that series.
Making the hook'em sign.
to each other?
Yeah.
Back in my Grandland TV critic days, you know, I love to point out that like, there are a number of unforced errors that writers, TV writers often make, but none greater than giving characters children when the writers actually don't want to tell stories about people with children. Carrie having Brody's baby on Homeland being one of the most egregious examples.
And then just giving it to her sister.
Yeah, just be like, take this baby. I have to go run around in Germany for a year. And I, to be clear, I fully respect the writers being like, we don't really want to do that. We'd rather, it's a better story for the show of Homeland, which is not a Herskovitz and Zwick, you know, emotional drama. All this is to say, I don't think the Marvel team is going to make that unforced error. I don't think they want to, especially with this, all the work they put into building Wanda as a major character and superhero in this universe, I don't think they're going to make her a single mom, because that's not the story that they're going to tell at this moment.
Best example of great parenting on television that I've seen recently is in the Netflix show Behind Her Eyes, which I watched recently. And in the middle of the season, it's like six episodes, the main character, Louise, who is ensconced in a love triangle with a psychiatrist and his disturbed wife, sends, after multiple episodes of her like not wanting to do this, sends her young son to France with her ex-husband just expressly so that she can just get up to some completely wild shit on the show and nobody has to be like, who's watching Adam, her son? It's
address
fantastic.
It. That's great.
Yeah.
This will come up probably in our later conversation about It's a Sin. It might come up if we ever get the opportunity to talk to It's a Sin's creator, Russell Davies, but I've been watching his previous series, Years and Years.
Yeah.
Which is available to stream on HBO and HBO Max. It is absolutely traumatic. I cannot believe anyone on planet Earth watched this during the year it was released, 2020. I can barely white knuckle my way through it now. But of all the horrific things in it, and for people who don't know, it's basically about the near future with a rise of like horrific like war and environmental crises and
immigration
second
bans.
Trump second Trump term leading to a Pence term and the rise of fascism and nuclear war and banks collapsing and just like everything that felt like it was happening happens in this show. The part that is absolutely like, you know, jump scare, lay awake all night for my household is the fact that in every scene, when people, this large family is either together or talking to each other via like the in-show Alexa, they are generally talking about things that have happened, like a local MP getting decapitated on live television by a drone or a nuclear strike on an island. And they're having these conversations in front of no less than three children. Like, and they never pause to be like, I know you're worried about the nuclear bomb siren going off in all of the world. Instead, they're like, this is the perfect time to get into it with great grandma about her incipient bias and racism. And I'm like, there are children here. There are children in the room.
I'm going to burn through the last couple of our loose ends. Dottie, played by Emma Caulfield. Do you think that she was definitely presented as somebody who I think we thought might be more important in this story? Early on when she like cuts her hand at the pool party, remember?
Oh, right, right.
Do you think she has anything coming up next episode or no?
No.
She's not canon, is she?
Not that I know of.
Yeah. And the last one is Ralph, which I think on one hand is just like a funny joke that you could say is like a sitcom trope of like my husband, but like I, you know, as we were all sort of like maybe reading too much into this and thinking, you know, is Mephisto coming out of this? Like, what's the deal? Like, who's Ralph? Who's her husband? Do you think that there's a possibility that there is another character reveal possibly there?
I think it's possible, but I also think it's worth noting, just because I think the lesson that I'm trying to internalize is that just because this was spread out over 8 or 9 episodes, the Marvel playbook is still the Marvel playbook.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't need to answer things
well
too quickly. I think I also want to see what
they put the big stars, or they put significant stars in this show. I still want to see whether or not they'll give up a plot point to a TV show, no matter how important streaming is to them. Mm-hmm. Will they introduce the villain of the next faves of the MCU in the last episode of a Disney Plus streaming show?
I would be very surprised. I think that Feige wasn't lying when he said this TV show exists to set up Doctor Strange 2.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the juggled schedule suggests that there wasn't anything crucial happening here that would, you know, Falcon and Winter Soldier was supposed to be over before WandaVision began, and now it's leading in reverse order into each other, which makes me think that if suddenly, you know, Al Pacino in red body paint swaggered out from behind the sword van, and then he's just like, gotcha. And then all of a sudden it's back to Prague with our buddies, Bucky and Sam. I feel like that would be tonally strange.
I agree.
I also think that for as much credit as we give to Feige and Marvel for flooding the zone with really out there comic book concepts, they are generally smart about the portions in which they deliver them. So this massive restructuring, not just of hinting at a multiverse, not just of completely empowering Wanda to the point of almost abstraction, but making magic such an important part of the Marvel Universe outside of that one movie where Khan from the Star Trek universe was wearing a cape. I feel like that's probably enough for now.
Yeah. Okay. That's all I got
Because the thing is, Chris, like this is the perfect, in a way, like summation of this mini conversation. They don't need to. Everybody's watching and talking about it, and people seem to really love it. They have another show coming in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Loki's coming not too far after that.
Like a month after that, yeah.
They don't have to. They're going to give us stuff that's entertaining, but they don't need to break out the big guns.
Let's talk about the real cinematic universe that matters. And that's the late Tom Clancy standing on the deck of a Navy battleship, wearing a hat of that Navy battleship and writing books about the Cold War and the post-Cold War and what that means to me as a podcaster, but also as an American. I cannot explain to our listeners how psyched I am for Without Remorse. I feel like I need it as like a tonic. I need it as like an alkaline drink. It's gonna revitalize me. It's like electrolytes. And it stars Michael B. Jordan, who will eventually become, I guess, Mr. Clark in the Clancy verse. It's his origin story of this like CIA kind of operative, this shadowy, completely off books guy. And it is directed by Stefano Salima.
I can't believe this.
Who directed Sicario, Day of the Soldado, 000, several 000 episodes, and a bunch of Gomorrah. It also stars Jamie Bell and Guy Pearce splitting the duties of Edward Norton from Born Legacy.
I want to be clear here. They really look like they were split like an atom.
Yes.
From one character. Maybe not evenly, because Guy Pearce has a couple inches on J. Bell, but it is just wild that they look almost interchangeable in this trailer.
And it was written by Taylor Sheridan, who obviously wrote the Sicario movies, wrote and directed Wind River, and writes and directs Yellowstone. Like, it looks sick. I need this movie. I need like a great action movie thriller like this. I think it will be absolutely bankrupt of morality. Like, yes. It is like a very, very fucked up portrait of like American defense lust. But I still really want to watch it, and I want to watch it now.
I mean, I can't believe your karma in getting this, because when the trailer...
I deserve it. I think
You've had a rough year, Dad. It's fine. When I heard about the trailer and like this, the existence of this.
Yeah, this is funny.
And you and Sean Fantasy started just doing backflips on Soch about it. You know, I was like, I'm happy for them. It didn't even mean like I wouldn't watch it, but that wasn't on my to-do list. And so then in preparation for talking to you today, I fired up the trailer. And then it's, I was like, boy, they're really biting Sicario vibes hard here.
The music is from Sicario.
Yeah, it's the big, like, you know, Prometheus blats. Boy, two shouts to Prometheus in one show. And then it says that it's Salima and Sheridan. I mean, how did one guy get so lucky?
Every 15 months, my hand comes through.
Here's what I want to say about this. And this is also clarifying, I think. Does this look morally bankrupt? Yeah, it sure does. Yeah. But that is not my approach to a movie like this. What I want, Chris, here's what I am. You know what I mean? I'm an old school blue collar coach. You know what I mean? I'm Gene Hackman in Hoosiers, basically. I mean, basically, almost you can't really tell the difference. And what I want is I want players in the best position to succeed. And if you're going to make right-wing jerk-off movies like this, make the best possible one you can.
Like light dudes from Gomorrah on fire in their BMWs.
And get those people to make it. You know what I mean? Like, don't half-ass this. Don't give me Affleck or Pine. Give me MBJ. You know what I mean? Don't give this to some journeyman like a John Turteltaub or something. Give it to the Salima. Bard of bloodshed, Stefano Salima. So I'm with you, and I'm thrilled, and I will gladly lose multiple brain cells to this motion picture.
Here's another hope I have, is that introducing Clark, or, you know, in this film, he's named John Kelly, I think.
Wasn't John Kelly the chief of staff?
Yes.
Are there no more Wonder Bread names to come up with?
Jack Ryan, what I'm hoping Tom is Kelly? That they remake Clear and Present Danger with Krasinski and Jordan. And they recalibrate the Jack Ryan that we have now back to a little bit more of the analyst dork that he's supposed to be in the books. A bunch of people on our Slack were talking about this yesterday, and they were right. Like, Bauman was talking about, like, Jack Ryan's supposed to be like an analyst who keeps finding himself in fish out of water situations, not like a greased up dude who like is able to fight his way out of situations.
Yeah.
So I mean, I'm hoping
you sound like me saying Spider-Man shouldn't be wearing Tony Stark armor. We're basically making the same point.
Same point. Really quick, Party Down. We're excited. That's got it.
Oh my God.
So you do it.
Yeah. I mean, do you guys know about this show? You must, right? That one of the great great comedies of the pre-streaming prestige era was this show Party Down that relatively few people saw when it was on. It was on Stars, produced by Paul Rudd and Rob Thomas, who did Veronica Mars and many other shows, created by and run by John Enbaum. And it was about a group of struggling actors who were working as cater waiters in Los Angeles. And it starred Adam Scott and Lizzie Kaplan, Ken Marino,
Martin Starr.
Martin Starr, first season, Jane Lynch, second season, Megan Mullally. It was everything that I love about TV. It was so deeply funny, but had the most wonderful, you just kind of love these losers sense of community and spirit, and also had these like these sneaky low bass notes of genuine emotion and romance that just made it absolutely irresistible. Two seasons are basically perfect. I realized today I had completely forgotten. I recapped the second season for Vulture. And it's the kind of project that there's so much goodwill towards it, but Chris Albrecht, who was running Stars, didn't really feel like it was worth holding on to. Many years have passed with talk of like everybody seemed to want to get back together and do it, but now they have made it work. And I don't know whether it came from the goodwill from like a live read they did in the fall, but or maybe just Albrecht's gone from Stars. And the show, I should note, is streaming on Hulu. So hopefully many, 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 many more people have found it. But this is one of those rare reboots that just fills me with happiness because everyone involved is fantastic.
Yeah.
The reasons for doing it seem so good, but also the central conceit, which is that these people know in their bones they're not going to make it. You jump forward 10 years.
I'm fascinated to see where the characters wind up.
There's a lot of potential pathos and comedy there in a way that's really nice. And it's just, this isn't exactly my Amazon Presents Jack Ryan's Without Remorse, but it's pretty exciting. It's just it's a purely happy story.
Yeah, I'm really excited for it. You know, that show and Eastbound were the two that really woke me up to the possibilities of what comedy could do on TV in this era. And so it's really cool. Obviously, McBride has continued to make not variations on Eastbound, but kind of variations on Eastbound and continued to put out really good stuff. But I feel like this group of people still had a lot of stuff to say and do. And so I'm really glad that they're coming back.
Did the shows you mentioned also open you up to the possibilities of what Adam Scott could do on television? Or was it the graphic HJ he received in Tell Me You Love Me that, that really was, made it clear?
I already had
this guy was all about
tons of
life.
Adam Scott stock because of that. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll discuss It's a Sin. This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power the collaboration needed for teams to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from sports exploration and green energy to delivering pizza and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 200, or 2 million, Atlassian software is built to help keep you connected and moving together as one. This episode is brought to you by UGG. Y'all know UGG is a brand that athletes wear all the time in the tunnel and on travel days. Well, I bet you think UGG season is only during the colder months of the year. Au contraire, you're wrong. You need to check out the latest spring drop from UGG. They have everything from sandals to clogs. I like the sandals. UGG has you covered for your next spring adventure. Shop the golden collection at UGG.com. This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, Get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details.
Okay, man. We're going to talk about the final three episodes of It's a Sin. I think we addressed the first two episodes in our initial conversation, just to sort of remind folks about what it is in case they don't know. And we're going to be doing spoilers here. So if you don't know, you might want to just hold on to this conversation until you finish the show itself. It's created by Russell T. Davies and entirely directed by a guy named Peter Hoare, who I'd never heard of before, but does absolutely astonishing work, especially...
He did great work on The Umbrella Academy.
Okay. And so he did... What he does in this final episode, I think, is worthy of recognition that we can save when we're talking about the final episode itself. But I was absolutely blown away by some of the staging of the final episode. And I thought it might be kind of cool to start here, which is one thing that's nice about seeing a show like this is we increasingly are talking about the cinema or movieification of TV and scope and grandeur, and whether it's auteur directors or whether it's bringing big budget special effects and multi-film franchise storytelling to television. But I felt like, especially in the last two episodes of It's a Sin, and especially in the last episode of It's a Sin, fittingly enough, given the occupation of some of the characters, I felt like I was watching an absolutely magical play. And part of that was because I felt like they were communicating social and historical ideas through these characters in an incredibly economical way that didn't require huge set pieces or over the top nods to like the time period that it was taking place in. Like they were able to do those things with one music drop and maybe one outfit change or a reference to something political happening, something on the TV. But the way in which they wrap this show up, which is at once incredibly true to the characters involved, but also is this amazing dialogue of ideas that still probably that matters so much and that really shaped how that time was experienced, both by the people who were affected by the AIDS crisis, but also how we understand it. I thought it was unbelievable. Like there's a couple of scenes towards the end of the series where Richie, who's the main character's mother, is having a conversation with Jill, who has essentially been Richie's caretaker for the final few years of his life. And the back and forth that they have, which will sear your eyebrows off and is really tough to hear, I just don't necessarily think we get to see characters of that complexity articulating such complicated adult ideas very often on television. And so I was just, I kind of thought we could start there. And kind of work our ways backwards.
I think there are two conversations to have about the show, both equally valid, but both are inextricably linked. One is the, not surface level, but screen level conversation about these characters, about the story, and about their emotional truths and conversations and ways they interact with each other. The other conversation is about the absolute mastery of the medium that Russell T. Davies exhibits. And I don't think you can talk about one without the other.
Yeah.
You know, I think you're right to say that there are moments that are as stripped down and pure and lacerating as theater. I also think that you're right to say that it just doesn't have some of the frippery that period pieces tend to do. There's not the montage of, you know, punks and Oxford Circus or whatever you need to let people know what's going on. But there's also these decisions that he made that I can't get over. Decisions like that feel almost greedy, but it's because he's so good at this, he can do it. I mean, start here. The American version of It's a Sin, which travels from 1980, follows characters from 1981 to 1991, would be at minimum a 10-hour show. More likely, it would be a 5-season show. You could get an entire season of television out of the first episode of It's a Sin.
Yeah.
But he doesn't, because he knows exactly the story he wants to tell, and he just gets it done. And there is a confidence in that kind of storytelling that I don't ever see in American creators and showrunners. And you see it in Years and Years, his other show that I'm watching now, where he's just like, I'm just going to gobble up this whole bit here and use it because that's all I want to do. And I don't need to belabor it or find my way into it. You know, it's all right here. And then the next part of what he does that I think leads us back to that conversation you wanted to talk about is he doesn't just know how to make TV. He knows how everyone watches it. And so mm-hmm. he does these just outrageous rope-a-dopes. And we talked a little bit about it last week, but everything that happens in episode 3 with Colin, your mind, your heart, and your body are screaming that this is a mistake.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't have it. It being HIV or AIDS, he doesn't. It's a mistake, but he's a victim of this healthcare world and this ignorance and the hatred of any homosexuality. And we're doing this because we just don't want it to be true, which mirrors the experience of anyone, the horror, who lived through this. And then when he reveals that he did, and how, it was there for us all along if we've been paying attention. And bring it full circle to what you're saying, I think you and I both saw from the first episode, Keeley Hawes, really good English actress.
Yeah, you see her in The Bodyguard. And
Bodyguard was the last
Line
show
of Duty
we
as well.
With her.
Yeah. Her season of Line of Duty is awesome. That's on Hulu if you haven't seen it.
And she's in the cast, so it's like the sleeping giant. And we see her in the background, and then slowly we realize, okay, she's Richie's mom. And in the times we see Richie's parents, and I think Sean Dooley is the actor who plays his father, he's fantastic too.
Yeah.
It sets up a dynamic that we are conditioned to expect, which is the father is unemotional, cold, and demanding, and will never accept any part of his son. And the mom just cares and loves him so deeply. And why can't he get alone with her so he could be true with her?
Right.
And the sleeping giant is sleeping. Sleeping giant is sleeping. One episode, two episode, three episode, four. When are we going to do this?
Yeah.
You know? And meanwhile, concurrently, we're doing the Colin thing again. Richie has to be the person, like Larry Kramer, for example, you know, who was significant in the 80s, came up in this era and contracted HIV, but lived long enough to be saved and to be having reflection. So this story must be Richie's story told in retrospect. And we willfully forget something that Russell Davies has said in interviews, which is the power of the show for him is that none of these people, quote unquote, mattered. They weren't famous. They were just people whose lives mattered to them and to their friends and loved ones. And slowly we're running out of time in the finale and like, how's this going to turn around? He's going to live. He said so at the end of episode 4. And then mom shows up and drops a nuclear bomb in the middle of the show and explodes its heart in a way that we don't expect and complicates everything and completely changes our perception.
Yeah, and it changes the show itself because the way in which it's shot is so different. You know, it starts and, you know, it starts and it's almost like a Daffy moment in like a TV sitcom moment. The parents unexpectedly arrive in town and blow up this secret that everybody has been keeping from them.
Oh, and they come with gifts for Christmas, even though it's November and there's a whole bit of business.
Right. And Richie's been in the hospital for a little while because his situation is deteriorating. And I am watching that scene and you're like, I understand how the rules of television work. So this is how this is supposed to go. You know, and the dad is going to storm out and the mom is going to keep this all together, but we're going to keep moving forward. Like they're going to go out into London and see Richie's life through the eyes of Jill and Ash or something like that. And then Davies locks the door. He locks the door behind you. Once you're in that scene, you're like, okay, so where's my exit, right? Where do I get out of this intense situation? And he just keeps ratcheting it up and ratcheting it up. And this show, I think I don't think I would critique it, but the show is almost too fleet of foot at time. You know, the show breezes through a decade. It sets up and dispatches with characters. It gets through the changing way that people perceived AIDS in the 80s and into the 90s, does all this work so quickly and deftly, and then it slams the brakes in the hospital. And it slams the brakes in this scene. And essentially what Hoerick does is start doing these tracking shots of Valerie, Richie's mom, walking up and down the hall of this infectious disease ward, having these different conversations, these different scenes. And there's, I think, two or three shots for about 10 minutes of footage where she goes from the hospital room to screaming at the nurse. Then she's grabbed by Jill and brought into a sort of private family room where their conversation is interrupted by the mother of another patient who is kind of like, I've been living with this and I have gallows humor and I'm taking the piss a little bit. And that sets Valerie off. So where she starts blaming Jill for not having told her. And then she storms back into Richie's room and is like, we're taking you home. And that whole sequence, I couldn't believe what I was watching. I just couldn't believe Keeley Hawes. I couldn't believe the variety of emotions that she was going through. And the best thing about it was I could never get a North Star in how I was supposed to feel. And I think that a lot of people are coming out of this show and they're like, but I have to say, I did not agree with what Lydia said at, or what Jill says at the end. Lydia West is the actress, but I didn't agree with what Jill said, or I didn't agree with this. And I understand that. Like, I definitely do. But I think one of the hardest things that we've been going through as a television watching culture is separating what a character says from what the author of the character's words necessarily believes. And what is true for a character might not be true for the right way to see a situation. But what I was blown away by was that Davies takes these archetypes, the Nightingale figure of Jill, the saintly mother of Valerie, and really, really fucking complicates them over the last 30 minutes of a show.
He has the grace, I agree with you totally, he has the grace to let every character be wrong, make mistakes, even be almost monstrous. Richie's denial and shame, as is revealed in the finale, led to him most likely infecting many other people.
Yeah.
For as awful as Valerie has been and can be, she is his mother and she holds him because she doesn't care if he's infectious. She loves him, you know, in her way. And, you know, I think that what Davies does that I'm so in awe of, and it's highlighted in the section that you're speaking to, is he somehow finds a bridge between two incredibly difficult poles, which I think are the goal of making TV. When you're writing a script, and this is not wisdom from me, this is just kind of something that people often repeat, characters have to want things, mm-hmm. you know, or else you don't have drama, you don't have action, you don't have momentum, you don't have scenes. In every scene, what does this character want and what does this character want? That sometimes runs afoul of reality, because in reality, if we're being honest, nobody knows what the fuck they're doing. Nobody knows. Yeah.
And
nobody
also what they want can change because there is a chain reaction in their interaction with another person.
Yeah. And so what he somehow manages, the needle he manages to thread here in this whole series is gives us people who clearly want things, have deep dreams and passions and the agony of the realization that they just won't get to have them is so painful. I mean, I said that the show wrecked me. It did. I would think about it after watching an episode, lying awake at night, feeling just devastated, wake up thinking about it, still thinking about it, but also just present their just almost radical humanity where they were kids. Nobody knew. And, you know, for as vicious as the show is towards bigots of all stripes, conservatives, people like Richie's mom, mm-hmm. you know, and she just gets walloped at the end by Jill, there is still room in whether it's Davy's heart or the show's heart to at least grant them the humanity that maybe they didn't know any better to, you know? And I think that's why I struggle to fully articulate my admiration and love of this show because it just messed me up, you know?
Yeah.
And this is a period of time, we should say, where sometimes I think we're a little bit older than our listenership. Maybe that's not the case, you know? But you and I were kids in the 80s. We weren't living in New York or in London. I don't think either of us were that particularly connected to gay culture or to, you know, the crisis of life that emerged with AIDS. But near the end of high school, like, I volunteered at a group in Philadelphia called Action AIDS. It was on people's radar. Popular songs and, you know, people that we really admired talked about it. But this is my own failing. I didn't. Maybe it's also being a kid and feeling invincible, but there was a piece missing, you know, in my understanding. And when I watch this and I feel I see young people get bulldozed by cruelty and fate, you know, and the most monstrous virus imaginable, it just kind of unlocked something and undid something in me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you and I grew up in very similar situations where we were going to like private school in Philadelphia, Quaker schools, where there was a pretty progressive, I would imagine, sexual education, if not curriculum, at least like culture of sexual education. Mm-hmm. And we grew up at a time where...
Did your school teach erotic thrillers like mine?
Yeah, we watched We watched Sliver.
It was an elective, but
my wife and I were talking about this last night. Like, I grew up thinking like sex could definitely kill you. You know, like that was definitely one of the mm-hmm. one of the tentpole ideas that you were introduced to as you were coming into like your sexual awakening was that this might kill you, or you might get somebody pregnant and they might not be able to get an abortion because of the politics of this country. And so I think there was a lot of fear coming into our like flowering or whatever the hell you want to call it, like our adulthood. And I remember like watching Pearl Jam Unplugged and Eddie Vedder writing pro-choice on his arm at the end mm-hmm. of the concert, like when they were playing their last song. And I was like, that was like, there's that. And then there's like, imagine being 18 and going to like Heaven nightclub in London and how different those two experiences must be. You know what I mean? Like you can't even begin to quantify what that effect that would have on you growing up.
But also, it's also a testament to the power of really good art, which I think this show is. It's one thing to be talked to or lectured on or educated about. Those are not... It was great when Michael Stipe wore 8 t-shirts promoting important causes. I agreed with those causes, whether they were gay rights or environmental action. But there's a surface level of communication there. It's not Michael Stipe's fault. It's not, you know, it's ultimately it was my fault for not learning more about things or understanding them in my bones or empathetically in my life. But I think that that's what art can do. You know, it can actually bring you into the boots of someone going to these nightclubs and seeing their entire futures mm-hmm. cut down like a scythe, you know? And so that's also why, you know, probably, you know, when Sorkin writes the biopic about this podcast, watching It's a Sin while watching WandaVision may come up. I'm trying to interrogate my own emotional reactions here. And I think just one show, they're not the same. It's great. Hopefully everyone watches and enjoys both.
Yeah.
I would never argue that one is more important than the other in people's lives because everyone needs a lot of different things all the time. That's not for me to say. But I do think that some of my vehemence or my exasperation came from having the wind knocked out of me by something so powerful and wishing that the superlatives of the culture were turned towards that. That's not fair, but I do think that watching the show at this moment influenced, perhaps unfairly, my reading of another show.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the other thing I was thinking about, this is unfair again, but the It's a Sin WandaVision connection is the difference between surprise and twist, and the difference between being genuinely taken aback by something that happens or something that somebody says versus just having that thing weaponized against you or having that surprise weaponized against you was really quite a juxtaposition. You know, and that doesn't even necessarily have to be some huge plot twist as much as it's just like a sentiment. Like I mentioned this to you on a text message, but my holy shit moment of this show, probably aside from most of the second half of the last episode, is when Richie goes to the riot or the demonstration that turns into like a police, you know, confrontation with the police in London. He said he wasn't going to go and he shows up and gets bloodied in his fight with the police. And that's what forces him to reveal that he has HIV to his friends. And there's this moment where it's like, oh, this somber thing. And then the next cut, it's his saying like, I'm going to live. And then they hard cut to Heaven is a Place on Earth as they go to the credits. And you just know right then that that's not going to be what happens. You know what I mean? Like that, and that setup, it's almost like that moment of pure triumph is when you understand the tragedy.
But it's also I think you understand the importance of hope, you know, because it's absolutely a bright, radiant, beautiful truth to him in that moment. Mm-hmm. It is a life-changing pivot, even if his life isn't that long.
And he never really lets that go. Like he never lets that sentiment really go, even in his last speech.
And it's these constantly brilliant, consistently brilliant creative decisions that just broaden and deepen the experience. And I'm thinking previously in that episode 4, you know, he goes back to the Isle of Wight ostensibly to talk to his parents. he's unable to do so. He goes out and he basically cruises his high school crush.
Yeah.
Who is
a bartender.
A bartender in a local in the Isle of Wight. And again, Davies knows what he's doing. He knows that our expectation is that this is going to go horribly wrong. Mm-hmm. That Richie will say something. He's getting drunk. He's going to say something off or make a pass.
This guy's going to beat him up or something. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, once again, Davies makes the more interesting choice. And the guy is put off a little, but also flattered. And also we see in his eyes that he is envious of Richie's comfort with himself, his exciting life, you know, and it's complicated and it's beautiful and it's surprising and it's everything that the show is. I want to, before we wrap up, there are a couple like smaller specific things that I want to
write. Sure.
Maybe you have a couple.
Yeah.
That just, I also love the show for these reasons. Perhaps my favorite low key thing is that, you know, this couldn't have been a cheap production. I think they filmed in Manchester mostly, I think even doubling for London. So they didn't have to pay those London location fees or whatever they are there. But they still found time in the midst of this for every moment that Richie or Jill or even tertiary characters are in a production of anything, they do the production. So we see Richie in what is clearly Doctor Who mm-hmm. from the 80s.
Yeah.
We see Jill in some sort of like bawdy Les Miserables review that is
I thought it must be Les Mis and they couldn't get the rights because she's like, I have a job for life. Like it's just going to run forever.
It's that version. It's something like that, you know, yeah. But they created it. And there's something so wonderful and like theater kid, let's just do it to that. And with these little like gags within gags that it just made me, it was delightful. You know, it is the spirit of the young people living in the Pink Palace writ large in this show. I think also worth mentioning, there are people, in the, like Neil Patrick Harris is in the first episode and Stephen Fry shows up. We mentioned Keeley Hawes, but this show makes stars. You know, Ollie Alexander is the frontman for a very popular band in the UK called Years and Years. He's incredible. It's a beautiful leading performance. This is Amari Douglas, who plays Roscoe's first screen gig and would like to see him in everything. Lydia West, who you mentioned, plays Jill, and she was in Years and Years previously. It's a challenging, sometimes thankless part because it is not her story, and yet it is her story. There's some criticism that I've read, you know, talk about how, and thankfully they kind of hang a lantern on it. They, Richie's mom basically says this to her in the finale, but Jill doesn't seem to have any life of her own. Her greatest passion seems to be caring for these boys, not pursuing any kind of romance or anything outside. Lydia West is just so effortless. You believe all of it. Mm-hmm. It's you know, we often, whenever we rave about stuff, they do tend to be projects that just launch people into the stratosphere. That's fun to watch. And I feel like we're onto one here.
Yeah. The only thing I wanted to mention was how impressed I was that how Davies is able to tell the story of a decade through these really small supporting characters. So the way you kind of see the way the medical community is responding to AIDS change over the course of time based on the interactions with different doctors throughout the show. So that by the end of it, it's a doctor who is having banter with Richie about like whether or not Richie's going to have a wank, like thinking about him or something. Like, and you know, they're actually like, they are engaged with AIDS as like for what it is and not like as if it's this like plague that is being handed down from heaven to take
biblical judgment. Right?
Yeah, exactly. And I also thought you could see that in, God, there's no wasted space in the show. The Richie's agent who shows up in three scenes. And the final one.
Tracy Ann Oberman.
And the final one is when she goes to drop off some money to so that Jill and Roscoe can go to Isle of Wight. She's just like, you need to go say goodbye. You know, like, and she has like this very, very, very short piece of dialogue. And it's exactly what this character is already known. Like she said, like a lot of boys are leaving and going home and then they never come back. She says that to Richie a couple episodes previously. And it's like the consistency of her character to show up three times in a show and always have something incredibly important to say, but not overdoing it. It's like, that's not too many people can write like that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's also fun once you've seen the show, which I imagine people who are listening this much have, there are a couple sort of meta things that you know, I didn't appreciate or notice, but the character Donald Bassett, who is mm-hmm. Richie's boyfriend in an earlier episode, is played by the actor Nathaniel Hall, who is very out about being HIV positive himself. Oh. The woman who plays Colin's mother, Jill Nalder, is a well-known in the UK anyway, Welsh actress, but also AIDS activist. And the character of Jill's mother in the show is played by the real Jill's mother, Russell Davies' friend who inspired the character. So it's the sort of stuff that doesn't matter when you're watching it, mm-hmm. but it just, when you're done and you're sort of, it's resonating and you're appreciating it, just the level of care and thought that went into it. Allison Herman had an interview with Russell Davies. We recommended and we retweeted. I would check out other things that he said about the show just because this is something that he lived through to a degree himself in the 80s and then kind of needed to wait almost 40 years to make the show. Mm-hmm. And you can tell. So we loved it.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's been clear.
Yeah. We will wrap it up there. We'll be back on Monday.
Do you notice that I have resettled my office at the Sturgis Motor Rally?
I can't believe
that
we finished the conversation right when the car alarm started going off.
It's kind of beautiful.
We'll wrap it up there. We'll be back on Monday to talk about WandaVision. And
are we going to talk about Coming to America?
Sure. Anything you want.
It's a damn shame what they did to that dog. I'm ready. Great weekend for Inskeys.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.